Hi, welcome once again to From the Center, a podcast by the Center for Western Studies. I'm your host, Jack Mao, on faculty with the Center for Western Studies, joined as always by my colleague and friend, the director for the Center for Western Studies, John Hodges. Good to see you again, sir.
Here's to you. It's a cold day in Memphis, and we're drinking
very
hot
cold
beverages.
We're drinking like hot chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
And I've retreated to the sanctum of the third floor, where it's much warmer.
Golly, it's single degrees outside in Memphis.
I told you when I was getting ready to come over here, I checked in my weather app. I was like, what's the temperature? And it said it was 9 degrees. But don't worry, it only feels like it's -1.
Is that all?
Yeah, well, that's all.
-1.
So, yes, I'm sure there's people, if we have people listening to us in, like, Minnesota somewhere, they're probably laughing at us, poor Memphians. But it is a very chilly day.
They always laugh at us. That's all right. That's all right. Our blues musicians are better than theirs. What can I say?
Hodges, don't cast asparagus at the Minnesotan blues.
Is there such a thing as the Minnesotan blues?
I wouldn't be surprised.
I don't think that's even allowed.
Maybe we'll find out one day.
A couple of sessions ago, we talked about how political entities seem to want to parse out aspects of what Jesus has taught and use them to support their political ends, right?
Right.
And from that, it seemed like we had a couple of tangential issues that we thought would be worth doing podcasts about. One was last week's, where we talked about the limits of politics, limits of the political sphere, because so many people are arguing now that everything is politics.
Right.
But there's also the tangent that we came up with about the institutional church. Seemed like our author at the time was complaining that the institutional church was the problem in many ways in our society, and had some suggestions about where to go to fix that, how to fix that. That we parsed out and walked through, but not to our complete satisfaction.
Yes.
So I thought maybe we ought to talk about that today.
I agree. The statement that usually gets made, and this is not going to be specifically about that article because I picked up on it there because I've heard it before. It's sort of a badge of honor amongst certain sects of theology, or even outside of theological or religious realms, even just in social cultural realms in general, there's some sort of badge of honor with people to be against institutions.
Right.
You know, institutional church being one of them that gets thrown around. I get frustrated by that statement for a couple reasons. One is I don't know what, on first blush, I don't know what they mean by institutional church. Are they talking about an actual physical thing? Are they talking about a state of affairs? I don't know what they mean.
A set of doctrines,
set of ideas. I'm not sure what they mean, but they say it with such urgency and such surety that it must mean something very important, but I wish I knew what it was.
Right.
The other one is it always feels unfair, because it feels like they're throwing a charge at something that has no way to defend itself. But there's just something about it that always feels unfair. They want to say, oh, it's all the institutional church's fault, or it's all the institutional media's fault, or whatever.
Right.
It usually is just the institutional church, I believe. Most people bring it up. But it always felt unfair, like they're being too simplistic about the way they're approaching it. And the third thing, I guess, if I'm counting off in my brain right now, maybe there's a fourth one, but the third thing that always bugged me about it is it just seemed like another one of those things. We've said the last couple of podcasts that we've kind of had to untangle things because they're very frustrating, because there's like truth mixed up with a bunch of falsehood.
Right, right.
And this one, there seems to be a genuine dislike of corruption or, I guess, petrification.
Sure.
Things like that. A genuine disdain for that, a moral contempt for that. But then they want to throw a bunch of other things under the bus with it. They want to say, like, well, the institutional church gave us all the creeds and all these doctrinal ideas.
Right.
Therefore, they must also be bad, and we have to throw them out. Yeah,
right.
We have to completely throw them out. I read another article by our esteemed Reverend Chris Hedges, the guy who wrote the other article, which was, I think it was from the same website, TruthDig, I believe,
and
it was entitled, I think, like, The Death of the Liberal Church. And by liberal, I think he meant, like, I don't think he meant liberal as in left-wing, but sort of like mainstream, evangelical, sold out to classical liberalism kind of church, I guess. And he had many of the same sort of points.
He mentions in there several of the denominations, specifically Methodism and Anglicanism or Episcopalianism or who are the other ones he mentioned? He mentioned Universalist, Unitarian Universalism.
Yeah.
Which I'm not even sure I can put that those in the same category, but that's but he did, and
he mentioned the prosperity gospel.
Well, eventually he does get to that. I think he thinks of that as the alternative, the poor, you know, the bad alternative to what was a thriving mainline denominational kind of Christianity in this country.
Right. And what I noticed in the second article I read is he said the only solution for the dying of the liberal church is radicalism. Which, I mean, part of me was like, well, sure, but, I mean, it depends on what radicalism you mean.
Exactly.
If you mean the radicalism that is the actual, you know, incarnate God-man that is Christ and all the stuff that flows out from that, all the consequences, doctrinal, creedal, practical, what have you, then yes, we need to return to that kind of radicalism.
That's truly radical.
I don't think that's what he meant, though.
No, but he specifically mentioned what he meant, I think. He talked at first about how the mainline denominations are losing members and their seminaries are going under, and he mentioned that he thought the reason for it was that they weren't radical enough.
Right.
And what he meant by radical, of course, was adopting a kind of liberal left, I'm talking about theologically liberal approach to life, seeing the work of the church as ministry to the sick and the poor and the dying and the hungry and the and all that, but sort of without all of the, as we talked about two sessions ago, without all of the other teachings that Jesus brings to the table to guide those things.
You see, that's probably, maybe this is a fourth thing, or maybe this is one of the other things I mentioned, or maybe it's all three things in one as the Trinity. But this is probably my main issue with why it irks me so much. We don't need to turn this into more talking about Reverend Hedges, because this is another.
No, he's just an example of a very prevalent way of thinking.
The issue is bigger than
much
bigger. And the issue is this: what bugs me is that everybody who wants to dismiss the institutional church, so called, and we need to talk about what in the world that even means, wants to dismiss all the creedal doctrinal stuff or have grounds to dismiss it. You know, they want to be allowed to dismiss it.
Right.
But I don't understand how you can get any of the practical radicalism of Christianity without the creedal, doctrinal, scriptural stuff that's been handed down.
Right.
If you throw out the Incarnation, if you throw out the Trinity, if you even throw out the Virgin Birth, and Jesus isn't he isn't, you know, born of the Holy Spirit, and yet he's born of Joseph, and therefore he's born of the line of Adam, and then he's just a sinner like the rest of us. That completely demolishes the whole thing.
That's right.
Right. So it's like I don't understand how you could possibly be a radical, so to speak, countercultural force as a Christian if you throw out all that other stuff. And yet I also don't see how you can disconnect that stuff from like an institutional church in a way.
Right.
Because let me start first. We'll start with definition. So here's what I understand the institutional church to mean. All right. As I understand it. Now, I've read elsewhere where I think what other people mean by it. But what I understand it by is, first of all, as an institution, it's something that is inevitable and natural because people are going to build institutions. Because the purpose of an institution is to preserve and pass on some good that a community or society wants. And that's inevitable, okay? You just like an anarchist community is eventually going to have some kind of governance because that's just how the way it's going to work, or else it's going to fall apart.
Right.
So any community, even an anti-establishment, anti-institutional community, is eventually going to create institutions because the originators of the community are going to get old and realize, you know what? The things we believe in are good, and we want them to continue. So let us pass them down through the institutions, whether it's the schools, the churches, the family, which is like a primary institution. We're going to want those things.
Sure.
So institutions are natural and inevitable. We're just going to make them. There's no way to avoid them. It's kind of like you keep doing the C.S. Lewis quote: "We're not going to read, you know, no books."
Right.
Pardon the double negative. We're going to read some books. It's a question whether good or bad ones.
That's right.
Likewise,
that's
we're not going to have no institutions. We're either going to have good ones or bad ones. So they're an inevitable, natural thing that whose purpose is to preserve and pass on what is considered the prime good for a society. That's what an institution does.
Very good.
So that's what I understand an institution to be. In light of that, the institutional church is the religious, I want to say, version of that. Like they pass on the highest religious good, which I guess, to be Chestertonian about it, is I guess they're passing on the ultimate good, right? The good of that's the good of your soul and your body and the whole earth. It's like the keystone to the whole arch. If institutions, if a society is built like an arch and you need all those stones fit together to make a society work, you have institutions that preserve those stones. You know, you need the education stones, and you need the next generation coming up. You need someone to take care of them stones. You need the political stones in some way. And you need the religious stones that, like, give you all those things. And I would argue, probably because I am a Christian, that the religious stone is the keystone. It's the one that holds it all together because it gives you the view of God, the universe, and everything.
That's right. And gives place to politics and to education and to any other institution that we may want to
establish. Sets them in a particular context.
That's right.
So when I hear institutional church, that's what I think of, an inevitable, natural thing that we create to hold and preserve some particularly religious, in a sense, ultimate good.
Right.
Now, that doesn't mean they can't go wrong. It just means that that's what it is. So when people attack that, number one, I don't understand how that makes sense because it just seems inevitable. How can you attack something that's just going to happen anyway? You're going to create your own institution. And number two, it's like, well, don't you want the ultimate good passed on?
Right.
So that frustrates me, but I don't think that's what they mean, these kind of people who are angry at what they call the institutional church. I actually don't think that's what they mean, all right? Like, this is what I hear when I hear institutional church, but I don't think that's what they hear.
Well, what do you think what kind of problems do they have with, say, a church that's established under the definition that you just given? What's the what could go wrong?
Well, one that I was trying to find articles about this, which I thought would be easy, but actually was kind of hard to find, oddly enough. From what I understand, when people who don't like the quote-unquote institutional church, when they talk about it, what they mean is that some sort of big, centralized, bureaucratized apparatus. You know, it's this thing that's become, when I say centralized, like the way they use it is power is being like held by fewer and fewer hands.
Right.
All right. It's been more localized and it's disconnected from the congregant. And it's by bureaucratized, I mean the ability for people to serve, for the congregants to serve, gets stifled by a bunch of hoop jumping you got to go through because the church has to now have to approve it in all kinds of ways.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And a third thing was that this giant, that's actually a third thing, is it's big. Like it's this big thing where you can get lost in, and it seems to just have this disconnection from its congregants kept popping up in some way. But a fourth thing was that an institutional church is more interested, that big centralized bureaucratic thing is more interested in its own survival than the actual preserving and passing on of some kind of good. I read an article, I can't remember from where, so forgive me, but I read an article that told the story of a lady. We'll just call her Emily or something like that. She lives in a neighborhood where she wanted to serve as a member of her church. And she's really good at art, like, I guess, painting and stuff like that. And she wanted to do art therapy because, like, hey, so that's a way I can serve. I know how to do that. So she wanted to set up, like, an art therapy ministry somewhere in her neighborhood, maybe in a room in the church somewhere before her neighbors. All right. And the church got in her way. The church she was going to got in her way. And they asked, like, well, like, you know, are you going to give them, like, a gospel message, ABCs of salvation kind of way?
Mm-hmm.
She's like, well, I mean, I'm not much of an evangelist. I'm an artist. Like, that's how I would evangelize, is by caring for them. I think Joseph Pierce would call it the apologetics of goodness kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But they were like, well, you don't have an ABCs of salvation. You don't, you know, you don't seem to want to talk about the church much. We don't see how this is going to bring, you're not talking about inviting them to the church. We don't see how this is going to put bodies in the church.
And that's the bottom line.
Right. And also, like, how they're going to, like, come to Christ, I guess, through this. And that second one is actually a bit more dicey, especially for us artist types. But she felt like her church, rather than supporting it, because she doesn't know what else to do. She also said that her neighbors are primarily Muslim. So, like, if her first move is, hey, come to my art therapy thing, like, sure, and they show up, and she's like, let's paint. By the way, let me tell you why your religion you've grown up with is wrong.
Yeah, right.
That's, like, the wrong way to go about
sort
it.
Bait and switch.
Yeah, it's a bait and switch type of thing, and she didn't want to do that. But it seemed the church was more interested in bodies in the pews.
I see.
Right? And the preaching of the gospel seemed to be almost like a quota thing. Like, you know, uh-huh. well, you're really going to get people. Now, I think it may be wrong to assume that that church was just thinking of its own survival. It's easy to think bodies in the seats is a kind of survival thing. Mm-hmm. So, but maybe it wasn't. Maybe it really just had a very narrow view of what ministry is. Mm-hmm. But the point is that that's what happens, mm-hmm. all right? Mm-hmm. Somebody wants to do this thing. They're truly gifted for it. They feel called to it. They see an opportunity for it. And the church they go to, which is supposed to help them, supposedly, with this, and want to do ministry to people, and I'll have all these different facets, gets in the way. Mm-hmm. And so there's another kind of element to it that is not just the bigness and the centralization, the bureaucracy and stuff like that, and interested in its own survival, but its view of what counts as ministry is super narrow. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like there's a lot of people out there who go to a lot of mainstream churches, and it's either A, it's so big they feel lost, like they don't know how to get involved, or B, it's set up in such a way that you really can't get involved unless you're an elder or something like that, or a class shepherd or something mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. And only the people, and also C, only the people who are, kind of been there a while and also are kind of in good with the administration, because, the pastor and stuff, are probably going to get the elder seats more often than not. Or they're at a church, wow. or they're at a church where the view of what counts as ministry, only falls under, preaching and door-to-door tract giving or something mm-hmm. like that. Like they don't, and everything else is something that they don't want to put their stamp approval on or give any support for.
It sounds like there's an awful lot of issues tied up in this, and yes. a lot of places where an institution like that could go wrong. Mm. And it occurs to me that the while I like your definition of an institution, I'm wondering if the church, with a capital C, is actually an institution then. Hmm. Because, we have man-made institutions. We have governing bodies. We have universities. We have educational systems, schools and various clubs and things that we put together. If you like basket weaving or stamp collecting, you can join a group of like-minded folks and you mm-hmm. can do those activities together, or attend sports or whatever you'd like to do. Or you can think, well, we need some sort of governance for our country or our state or our city. Mm-hmm. And so we create institutions that will help govern and so on. But it seems to me that the church is a different entity then, if that's because, first of all, it doesn't seem like it's man-made. Mm. Right, the church is made up of people, certainly, like any other institution is. But it seems to me that it's God that draws them to the church, mm-hmm. and then it seems to me that the goal of the church is a different thing than all the concerns. It seems like you were just mentioning. Could stem from a misunderstanding of what the purpose of the church is. The purpose, if I understand it right, is to glorify God and to be the body of Christ in the world. That is, the extension of Him in the mm-hmm. hearts and minds and hands and feet and so on of the believers of His followers in this world.
Right.
And then the church, in that sense, the church isn't a building, certainly, mm-hmm. and it's not a bureaucracy, except insofar as the Scripture actually directs us to organize in a certain way.
Some kind of organized church. Here's the thing. I like how you mentioned church with a capital C, and how that's not really an institution as I've defined it, because that seems built and maintained and passed on by God, right? It's a supernatural thing. It's not a human natural thing. Every time I saw people talk about the institutional church, it was always lowercase c,
uh-huh.
which made me wonder, are they talking about like a specific physical church that becomes an institutional church in some way? Like institutional yeah. church is like a state of being for an actual physical building with people running it and stuff like that.
That's right. And I think that's what they mean. And I think that our author was talking specifically about what we used to call mainline denominations.
Right.
And that by that he means, too, a kind of uniquely American church. This is there. I mean, obviously, the mainline denominations are established in other countries. But what he's actually talking about is a kind of a manifestation of the church in the mainline denominations within the United States, sort of ethos or something.
Right.
Love of individualism and love of established institutions, like the Methodist Church or like the Anglican Church or the.
Or the Constitution.
Exactly, the right. Constitution. Exactly right. But the church actually isn't those things, it seems to me. The church is the body of believers wherever they are, wherever they find themselves, gathered together in order to offer worship to God and in order to benefit from fellowship with Him. So that the work of the church in the culture is to be a place where corporate worship can go on, and a kind of equipping, a place to equip believers to be able to go out into the world and be salt and light in their various aspects of the world, whether they're teachers or artists in this case, or politicians or whatever they're doing, bankers.
Does that tie back to what you meant when you said maybe it's a misunderstanding of what the church is supposed to do?
Yeah.
Because you said that it's supposed to, in addition to all those other things, equip the believers, the congregants, to go be salt and light. And it sounds like our Emily, so to speak, we're calling her, wanted her church to equip her somehow.
Right.
But maybe it was the wrong way. But not just her. Maybe her own church saw their equippingness as the wrong way to go about it. You know, that our equipping you is you sign on the dotted line and you check all the boxes off right and you fulfill your quota and you have to do it this very specific way. And that's how we equip you, as we made sure you did it via protocol, something like that.
Well, there's got to be a little bit of accountability of brother to brother, you know, within the church, that we're all supposed to do that for one another. So I can see some reason for coming up with some way to, you know, talk about what our purposes are and so on. What concerned me, I guess, was the picture you drew of the church's response to Emily that sounded like they valued people. They value two things. One was, how often are you proclaiming the gospel specifically? And two, how many people are you bringing into the church? And neither of those was on her mind, it seemed to me. Now, I'm not saying that she wasn't going to be living out her Christianity in the thing that she was doing. Don't get me wrong.
Right.
But she wasn't. I mean, it wasn't a sort of evangelistic thing like you were talking about specifically. It wasn't, I'm going to hand out tracts to my Muslim neighbors. It was. She called it art therapy. I'm willing to say that the value of art is in doing the art by itself. I'm not even thinking that it needs to be therapeutic specifically. But she saw a need for that, or wanted to try and do that,
or she felt it was a good thing
that she could do, that she knew how to do already, and so on. So it looked to me like there was a conflict of goals there, you know, between her and her church. And so there needed to be some kind of clarification about that. But the church as a whole included her, whether that particular denominational church, whatever, supported her specific ministry or not. She, by profession of faith, you know, was a part of the church, just like you'll find believers in all of the denominations we've been talking about. And plenty of people who are not believers, I think, in all of the denominations we've been talking about.
That's the thing. It's like we belong to the big C church, but that is manifested concretely by the small C church we call home in some way.
Right.
And it feels like to me, and this is, again, part of the frustration, this is another kind of frustration, is that when I get away from, like, politicos and talking heads, and I try to get to people who really feel frustrated by this. I keep using the word frustrated. I can't find a better word. I need to improve my vocabulary. But people who are really, feeling deflated and sort of pinned in by this, there's this sense that they belong to the Big C Church, and that Big C Church welcomes everyone, so to speak, through Christ. But their small C church has all these, well, it itself is kind of a person that just won't give you what you want or won't do what you want. I'm trying to word this in such a way that doesn't make sound like people who get complaining about the institutional church, so to speak, are just a bunch of whiners who just want things the
wrong
way.
Right.
I understand the frustration. Can you comprehend how frustrating it is if you're somebody who, you know, your gifts are artistic or your gifts are kind of intellectual. And by intellectual, I don't mean you're smarter than anyone else. I just mean that ideas are sort of your medium. You know, like wood is the medium of a carpenter. Ideas is the medium of an intellectual.
Sure.
Your gifts and talents that God has given you lean that way.
Yeah.
But the church you go to has a very super narrow view of what gifts are and what things are. And if you say, well, I want to start up like an art class so people can learn to appreciate art and maybe appreciate God through art, through, you know, what Joseph Pierce would call the apologetics of beauty, right? Or you want to set up a class that's like, we're going to read through. I think it's good for our, you know, youth group to maybe have anyone who wants to come and we'll read through, you know, Nietzsche or something like that because they need to know this, right? And you think that it's valuable and important for the Christian walk, but your church is like, we don't need any of that, you know, highfalutin liberal stuff in our church. All you need is the gospel or something like that.
Sure.
Can you imagine how frustrating that would be?
Sure.
I feel like the more sincere frustrations about the institutional church, one that's kind of divorced from some sort of anterior political agenda, are people who want to be useful for God and want to be of service to God. But the small C church they go to not only seems to just kind of have nothing for them, but maybe for some it feels like that small C church actively stifles them.
Right, sure.
And they go to other churches, I guess maybe mainline churches, and find the same thing. And so the assumption is, well, I guess all institutional churches, churches that have some sort of concrete organization and hierarchy and stuff like that, are the problem. I understand that frustration. On the other hand, I don't see how quote-unquote, getting rid of the institutional church is a solution. So I guess the thing I would want to explore is, A, is their complaint a valid complaint? Or is there parts valid, parts invalid? And B, what is an actual solution? I mean, is it just, let's chuck the whole institutional church out, you know? I mean, I think some things are kind of obvious, you know, like, well, you know, Trinitarian theology gets in the way of my personal like beliefs. I'll just chuck that out. Okay, that's just stupid. Or maybe I should say that's just foolish. Okay, that's completely foolish. But I'm trying to avoid those super extreme wings of it and trying to pull it into the more understandable, frustrating, knotted center, which is like there's a valid frustration, or it seems to be a valid frustration, or an understandable frustration, but the solution doesn't seem to be the right solution. So what do we do?
You know, when I was in college, I bought my first car, and it was a little sports car. It was a little Triumph Spitfire. 1974 Triumph Spitfire. It was a used car, of course, at the time, but it was not that used. It was maybe 6 years old, 5 years old, something like that.
My gosh.
And I drove that. It was fun to drive. And I drove it for, you know, maybe a month or so before something went wrong with it. And I had to learn to fix it. And I think it was the clutch master cylinder went out. So I had to learn how to fix that. But before I could get much driving in on it again, the electrical system started acting up. And I had to replace some parts of that. Or the heater didn't work. Or the radiator sprung a leak. Or the brake pads needed to be replaced. And it just seemed like, especially with the electronical part of it, the electronics part of it, it was just a lemon of a car. You know, it just had problem after problem after problem. Well, my brother is a much better mechanic than I am. And he looked at that car one day, I remember thinking, and saying, I'm astonished that this car drives at all with all the problems that it's got, you know, and constantly being. And I'm thinking that's a little bit how I look at the institutional church, that is the small C churches that we have. If given the fact that we're all sinners, given the fact that we are, that God is taking us and sanctifying us slowly, you know, and it takes generations for this sanctification of a group to happen, you know, for an organization to happen, it shouldn't surprise us at all that there are all sorts of problems with it. Now, neither my brother nor I wanted to get rid of the car.
Yeah,
we just wanted to see it run as best as it could, because when it was running, it was loads of fun, you know, great little roadster. But it's the same thing with the institutional church. Jesus said to Peter one time, after he had said some pretty provocative teachings, a lot of people have left. Are you going to leave me too? And Peter said, where can we go?
Right.
where can we go? You have the words of truth. If not you, then what? Right? And I feel a little like that with the institutional church. This is the church that God has established in the world. And it's got all sorts of flaws, all sorts of wrinkles and problems. And it's not, but I think we think that, here's how I think the natural mind looks at things. If the institution has any flaws at all, then I can't trust myself to it and I'm going to criticize it.
See? Right.
But what God says is, that's not how I dealt with you.
Right.
Thank God he didn't deal with me that way, right?
Right.
I think, well, what would he have done if he'd looked at me and said, you know, you got flaws, nah, next, you know? No, he said, I love you so much that I'm willing to die in your place so that you can claim the righteousness of a perfected sacrifice, a perfect sacrifice in Jesus himself. And then we can do the hard work of working all this nonsense and foolishness and deep self-absorption, which is what sin is, out of you, little by little, right? Okay, well, imagine you get thousands of these sinners who are honestly in the process of trying to be sanctified, working with God, cooperating with him about their sanctification. And you put them together in the same place, and you ask them to actually relate to each other and work together as a body. And Jesus gives us all these instructions about what kind of gifts and how we ought to, we're not all ears, we're not all eyes, we're not all hands, we're all going to be different. Mm-hmm. And yet, we're all going to work together. And we stumble all the time. Every single one of us screws up the stuff that we've been given to do. So the aggregate screw up of the church, you know, it's pretty massive then.
Like the aggregate screw up. That's
yeah, the aggregate failure of the body, all these individual cells of the body, as it were, making their own mistakes. But God somehow brings the church along and continues to support it and love it and perfect it. You know, that whole idea of the bride being washed with the word, you know, and continually improved and continually all out of love for the bride, you know.
Right.
I think that kind of attitude is what we ought to bring to the table. I'm not asking for us to sort of choose optimism versus pessimism.
Yeah.
Chesterton, as you might have heard of Chesterton, right?
Yeah, I believe so.
You've heard of him. He actually said something great, I think, about optimism and pessimism. The optimist is the guy who says that whatever it is we're looking at is so good that it doesn't need to be changed.
Right.
Right, which is foolishness, especially with regard to sinners. The pessimist, on the other hand, says there's so much wrong with this thing that I'm not even going to bother to change, to work on it.
Right.
And neither of them actually accomplish anything.
Right.
But the realist is the guy who says, I see the flaws, but I also see the potential, and I'd like to be able to help that potential become manifest, you know, more and more as we go. And if we look at the church that way, I think, then we expect hypocrisy. We expect, sadly, we expect people to fail and make mistakes. And the difference that I heard somebody say one time, the difference between a Christian and a non-Christian is not that the Christian never fails. It's just that when the Christian fails, he fesses up to it and asks forgiveness and goes on, you know, cleans up after himself kind of thing.
Cleans
up his own messes, you know. I think maybe we need to tweak our understanding, not of institutions, but of whether or not the church is an institution, and if so, in what way God intended for it to be looked at and lived out in the world.
I was thinking, okay, so if we see the church, capital C, as this supernatural thing built and maintained by God and Christ.
Yeah.
And it has institutional trappings because it's manifested through us, basically,
yeah.
And this is how we do it. And there is some scriptural organization for a church and all kinds of things. And then when an individual lower C church gets built, it's going to have, hopefully, that organization, that Christ at the center, that organization is kind of like a substructure or substrata. And then whatever gets built on top of it is probably going to be unique to that environment or that culture or something like that.
That's right.
Is that right? Okay.
That's right.
An additional problem, an additional wrinkle I can see is this. It's one thing to like go into a church, small C church, and see there's flaws, there's problems, there's hypocrisies, there maybe is corruption even or something like that. But let's stick in there and work with it and try to fix it. It's another thing, I think, maybe, we'll see. It feels like it's another thing and something that is definitely unique to America in places that are influenced heavily by American or Americanization or something like that. The problem, I said, of bigness.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. It's one thing for a church to have hypocrisy and stuff and corruption, all these issues you got to work with. It's quite another thing when a church is so big that if there is hypocrisy or corruption or issues or flaws or, hey, maybe we could tweak this, it feels like getting to work on it just gets completely washed out. People look at it and they see something happens and then they want to do something, but instead this massive, big apparatus squashes it or tries to stifle it or says
just the very size becomes a weight in and of its own and a momentum that's impossible to
right. I mean, it's what if I like was at a church that's like I'm small. It feels relative to say what small counts as, but it's like a church where you actually like the pastor knows who you are, because the congregation is big enough to be a church, but small enough to where the pastor like knows everybody, and you could just go straight to them. All right, you just say, like, hey, here's this issue, I'm really worried about it, and you feel like they'll actually listen to you because they know you. In other words, it feels like a community.
Right.
Right? A church that feels like a community. If a church gets big, it suddenly starts feeling like a business almost.
That's a real problem.
With the business model.
Sure. And the problem, I think, is extended into the way and the way things are done and the goals that are set for a church that becomes that large. I've heard people argue that if a church gets over a certain number, then it must resort to a kind of CEO model business structure in order simply to accomplish anything. And yet, I'm reminded of something. I hope this will address what you're talking about. I'm reminded of something Francis Schaeffer used to say, that it's not enough to do God's work. You have to do God's work in God's way. And I think God's way is counter that sort of CEO model.
Yeah.
We don't think in terms of hierarchy of in a business model, a CEO and a board of directors and a sort of business model bottom line approach to setting goals and that sort of thing. It's very tempting to act as though the church is a business and the business is getting, you know,
butts in the seats.
Exactly. So getting numbers up, getting ratings up, getting donations up.
Having good visibility.
Yeah, exactly. Lots of positive publicity or something like that. All of that seems to fly in the face of what actually should be happening, which is that we have been looking at the entire world upside down all along, you know. And Jesus comes along and says, the last will be first, and the first will be last, and the greatest of you will be the servant of all, that kind of attitude. Mm-hmm. And we think, you know, you need to go to seminary, and then you need to get in as a youth director someplace, and then you work your way up the ladder to senior pastor.
You minored in business, so, you know.
Yeah, right, so that you know how to handle that kind of ladder-climbing matter and set up a church that can be established that way and so on. It seems to me that that's why I say I think institutions may have similar processes and hierarchies and so on, but the church is an entity. You've heard probably the cliche, it's not an organization, it's an organism. And I think that's a fair view of what the church is supposed to be, like a set of cells that relate to one another and work together to accomplish certain ends, and everyone respecting the gifts of the others. And that can go on with a very light hierarchy, I don't think, as long as everybody is interested in pulling in the same direction. But the problem is we're all sinners. That's why I go back to the idea that we're going to find hypocrisy, we're going to find wrong being done in the church. Now, but I want to make a clarification, by the way, about that before I leave that subject. You mentioned corruption, you mentioned hypocrisy, and so on. I am not advocating that we, once we see those things in the church, that we somehow poo-poo them. Oh, it's no big deal. It's not a yeah. big, you know, we should just allow that because we're all sinners and so. But that's not what I'm saying at all. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is that we should expect that to happen, and then we ought to have some way to address it. And I think the scripture is very clear about how to right. address it and what it means to call our brothers and sisters to account and what it means to have church discipline right. and all that stuff. We don't have to go into all that. But I'm by no means trying to say that those things are unimportant or should be overlooked because they're natural to the human condition. The beauty of the church and the beauty of the gospel is that it gives us a way to address those sorts of things mm-hmm. so that we can be sanctified. We are going in working in a process. So there's a difference between the guy who says, I'm sinning and I'm going to continue to sin because I'm just somebody who is a sinner and I'm just going to do what I like. Right. And I want you to accept me in the church.
Shall we not sin that grace may abound?
Exactly. Kind of thing. Exactly. If somebody were to come along and say, well, you know, what difference does it make? You know, I can sin and God's just going to love me anyway. And let's just enjoy our, you know.
Who are you to judge me anyway?
Right. There's that guy. And then there's the guy who says, I have sinned and I'm really not happy with myself about that. I know God loves me anyway, but he also doesn't want me to continue in this direction. I want to repent. Help me. Mm. And it's those guys that are the church.
Right.
It's those guys that are the church, wherever they are, whether they are five guys in a 5,000 member congregation somewhere mm-hmm. or whether they are five guys in a five-member congregation, maybe the percentages are, you know, 0.1% or 100% right. of your church is that sort of arrangement. Those are the guys that are actually living it out. And that's what I say. With those guys, you still can expect these hypocrisies, these problems, these sins to come up, but they're going to address them in the way that God intends us to be addressing them.
I feel like that's almost... In some ways, that's almost what you have to do in these situations, because there's lots of us who feel probably out there caught in a big church, mm-hmm. right? In some mm-hmm. big, massive church. And that doesn't mean necessarily the church is wrong or bad, necessarily. Or bad, I should say. There's plenty of big churches here in Memphis who do a lot of good work.
Absolutely right.
You know, there's nothing, it's not like, I'm not sure bigness is a sin, all right? Bigness may just be inevitable. It's kind of the I don't know, the indie artist conundrum. You know, you want to stay true to your indie art values and not sell out to the mainstream. But if you get popular, you know, you're just suddenly like, how do you avoid getting sucked into that thing? If right. you're doing something good and people flock to you, you're going to become huge. Like, you're going to become big, and then you're going to be faced with that problem. You know, like I said, once you get big, it's almost like you can't help but have a CEO model or something like that.
Yeah, I'd like to think that that's not necessary, but I also understand that you're right in that everybody is going to be drawn to some kind of structural organization if they get big, and big organizations have problems that little organizations don't have.
Yeah, I almost heard there's a church near here, Bellevue is one. And I've heard people say, have been there, that they realize that Bellevue is not so much one big church as much as it's like four or five smaller churches uh-huh. who all kind of meet under one roof uh-huh. and in one congregation. And that wasn't meant to be a knock against it. It was almost like that. I mean, unless you want the CEO model to take over,
that may be a way to avoid it.
That may be a way to avoid it. I'm not sure how Bellevue runs itself, but that idea of like, well, if you like, how do you avoid the, if you get so big, you don't turn to the CEO model? It's like, well, maybe you start seeing yourself as like several small churches that meet under one roof rather than one giant, you know, just one giant church that has to be run by one person or one small group of people or something like that.
Well, and I've been in churches where it was a huge church, but they have a structure of Sunday school classes and small, what they small call small churches or Sunday school classes or whatever, that are sort of communities unto themselves, you know. And it's in those things, in those communities, that you can become accountable to one another and grow in your faith and all of that. So there is a way, I think, there is a way to do it God's way and not lose the intimacy that you need to have with one another and the accountability you need to have with one another.
So... In regards to if institutional church means like some big corporate model church, that is a problem. But yeah. there are ways to deal with it that don't involve, you know, abandoning Low C Church altogether or something like that.
Right, right. And one of the, I remember our author said something like, these mainline denominational churches are dwindling in our day. They're getting smaller, and as a result, fewer people are going to their seminaries to learn to be leaders in those churches. And so the seminaries are going under and sometimes consolidating with one another and so on. Mm-hmm. And his argument was that the reason that deterioration is happening is in the institutional church is that they have left their Christian roots.
Right.
And I thought, hooray, I agree. I think that's probably true. But then he wanted to say that what their Christian roots were this sort of social justice model, liberation theology, like we talked about a couple of sessions ago,
right.
And that if they only were to become more radically left wing, that they would somehow find themselves thriving. And I think he's not looking at the world very clearly, because it's the conservative churches, the ones that have stuck to the teachings of Jesus and have, I mean, the whole teaching, mind you, not just the part about dealing with the poor.
But all of it.
But all of it. They're the ones that are growing.
Right. Like the Orthodox Church?
The Orthodox Church, but I'm thinking about some of the evangelical churches even. There are large evangelical churches that have said, we actually have placed ourselves under the full authority of the Scriptures in every aspect, and we're doing our best to walk in the Spirit in that direction. And in other words, seeing the problems of our day in terms of the sin of man and the glory of the gospel that has come to free man from sin as the essence of what the church is teaching. The good news is that you can be freed from sin. Instead of the work that we're here to do is to, in a sense, put Jesus aside, except insofar as to say that he was, like we've said in that older right. article, that he was an oppressed person, and so we have to relate to him, and so we should be relating to oppressed people of the world. Well, that's one facet of what he calls us to do, and it can be done in the wrong spirit. And what I think is happening is people are exchanging the depth of the spiritual teachings about sin for a kind of practical, almost political,
I don't know, just version of it. I mean, the way I think of it is, when I was reading stuff like this over the last week or so, or last few days, it seemed to me that their frustration was with what they felt was a extremely capitalistic church, you know,
right.
the CEO model
right.
church, you know. That's interested in the bottom line, and the bottom line may be literally profit, or it may
sure.
be like a quota of persons or whatever, but regardless, it's like a CEO model, therefore it's like a capitalistic church. And they don't want that, because that feels stifling and all the stuff we talked about.
Right.
But they want to exchange that. Oh, let's go to the real church. What's the real church? A Marxist church.
Exactly.
Like that's the thing.
Exactly.
It's like,
that's what I'm trying to say.
Right.
Eventually, it becomes a kind of Marxist understanding. It's like all of us have been so steeped for the last 200 years in a kind of materialistic mindset mm-hmm. that only things in this materialistic mindset can work. And you divide the group into the Marxists on the left and the capitalists on the right. And the two of them simply duke it out.
Right.
And Satan laughs at that. He just loves the fact that we've done that to ourselves.
Both those groups fundamentally agree that the ultimate good for the human person is materiality in
right.
some way, material goods and services. Now, they disagree on how you acquire those goods and services.
That's right.
And how you go about producing them and consuming them. But they still both agree that's the ultimate good. Right?
That's right.
And that's what needs to be organized. So if you look at a church that's doing the CEO capitalistic model, then you see, you know, well, they're just trying to organize certain material goods towards their own selfish ends. You know, they're organizing it towards their own survival, when we should be organizing it towards the poor and the oppressed and the downtrodden.
That's right.
Not realizing that maybe on both sides of that you've forgotten the gospel. Like the gospel
right.
which doesn't say your poverty will end. It says that your sins are forgiven.
Yes.
And in light of that, you can go help the poor.
Sure.
You know, there's like that complicated thing, which is too much to unpack right now, but it's that kind of, I guess, the real radicalism of Christianity. And that brings me to kind of, I guess, the last point, which on the most, I said we ignore the extremes and we kind of stick at the center, but on the extremes, I feel like that might be where the more ridiculous parts of this come from, that in rejecting the institutional church, we have to reject everything after the Council of Nicaea forward or something like that, because all of that was doctrines and creeds endorsed by a militaristic state-owned church that just is interested in its own survival. It's the same kind of attitude like, you know, the Constitution is inherently bigoted because it was written by white patriarchal men, and thus the rights and the Bill of Rights are meant to service power. And so we need to stifle free speech, actually, because we need to stop those daggum alt-right you know, racists from having, Nazis from having a word or something like that. Sure. Because the Bill of Rights only services power. It feels like it's the same idea. You know, the Trinitarian theology only services power or something. Or, you know, the virgin birth only services power. Or, you know, the substitutionary atonement or something like that. And therefore, we have to ditch all of that. And you don't, it's like you can't view, there's something more than just power behind these, like, it's a whole discussion about the male libido thing. It's like it's a wrong view of power.
Right.
Just like you have a wrong view of, like, our world is materiality fundamentally and material goods are the ultimate thing for us. So if somebody has doctrines or creeds and it's tied to some sort of powerful apparatus, therefore it must be attached to power, which is necessarily attached to oppression. Therefore, it's part of the problem. Therefore, we need to get rid of it.
Yeah.
And you can completely miss what the incarnation does, what the Trinity does, what the atonement does, and what it, not just spiritually, but in all, not just abstractly or theologically, I mean, but practically, both spiritually and physically for your life. I feel like I just rambled a whole lot there. Does any of that make sense?
Sure. Yeah, I think so. We've got an institution, and that institution is flawed, but it's an institution that God has established and intends to sustain out of love for us. I think if we can figure out a way to love the institution too, because of God's, I keep calling it institution, but I like the word organism better. But I mean, since we're talking about the institutional church in quotes, the establishment of an organization for believers to work through is a good thing. The fact that it has flaws in it is to be expected, but that also have to be addressed. But then thirdly, like you're talking about, the weight of it, the bigness of it, the bureaucracy of it is sometimes part of the problem. And so we have to go back to this idea that we do God's work, but we do God's work in God's way. And the way of God's work often is, for example, prayer. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily establishing a new program to accomplish some end, but to beg God for His strength to be able to be the thing in the midst of the culture that we need to be, and you know the way He does things is through death, and nobody likes that. You don't like the death of yourself. You don't like the death of your dreams. You don't like the death of your financial status or your institution in the end.
Right, or your brilliant ideas.
Your brilliant ideas. You think, well, no, nobody should be killing off my ideas or my institutions. And yet, martyrdom is actually the way He accomplishes a lot of things. See, so I'm not just trying to be melodramatic here. I'm saying that there's a principle that in God's way of doing things where death to self brings life. Mm-hmm. It's the death on the cross, ultimately, that brought about the life of our spiritual selves. And on a smaller scale, it's death to ourselves that brings about life in the culture. But we don't inherently, you know, part of our sinfulness is that we don't like dying. We don't want to die. Nobody likes to die. Mm-hmm. But that's the way He does it. And so it may very well be that to do God's work, which looks on the surface like feeding the poor, for example, which is God's work, we are called to feed the poor, but to do it in such a way as that I die and they live, that sort of self-sacrifice way, I'm talking about spiritually now, talking about not just my financially, although it's that too, is a way that seems to have no power, political power looks like it's immediate. It looks like it's something that we can get our hands around. If we could just get our hands around it, right. We could make something happen. We could start a program. We could organize a parachurch organization. We could become elders. We could elect the right president. We could all these
the
power
right legislation.
Things.
Right.
That's right. Get the right legislation passed and so on. That would sort of make this thing happen, right? But God says, hang on a second. I'm actually asking you to put you and all of your dreams second and call on me to accomplish. I'm doing this. You're not doing it. I'm doing it. Mm-hmm. And if you're trying to join, you would need to be joining me, God, in the work that that I'm doing. And we like the idea of thinking, well, I did it. You know, I accomplished this. I'm pushing for this. I'm a virtuous person because I took up this job and I'm pressing forward. And, you know,
see, that's the other side of
that's
it.
That's part of what it means to be a sinner.
Yeah. I was like, that's the other side of it where I'm going. I understand the frustration of feeling like, you know, your usefulness or you attempting to like whatever, like do this thing that you feel gifted and called to or being stifled or muddied up or something. It's super frustrating. On the other hand, I don't want to just check off on that because the church, whether big C or little C, does not exist to put the stamp of approval on all your little harebrained ideas, whatever they are.
Right.
Not that our Emily person had a harebrained idea, but
sure. It's
like you want to shoot the gap between these two things. You don't want like a church that stifles everything. You don't want a church that just approves everything. And sometimes I feel that people who complain about the institutional church, sometimes they have a legitimate problem because there's a legitimate issue. But sometimes I can't help feel there are others who complain about it because they are sucked up into individualism and feel like, how dare anybody get in the way?
Get in the way of my individual goals.
Well, the church, what the physical small c building should be there to service my opinions and my ideas. How dare you throw your doctrinal, creedal, scriptural, institutional stuff in my face? You're the problem, not me.
Yeah.
And part of me feels like looking at it that way, a solution, so to speak, not an easy one, but one that involves self-sacrifice, involves it, is that we need to learn how to actually love the church better. Mm-hmm. You know, to love Christ and therefore, as a part of that, loving his bride, mm-hmm. with a capital C, and therefore loving the specific manifestation of it that we happen to belong to. You mentioned that earlier about a few minutes earlier about how we need to like love the church we belong to, and it reminded me of this guy called Chesterton. When he talked about somewhere, he said that, you know, Rome wasn't, men didn't love Rome because she was great. She was great because men loved her.
That's right. That's right? Exactly what I'm saying.
And he said people complained about something called Pimlico, which I can't remember if it was like a...
Pimlico.
Pimlico. I can't remember if it was like a city or a department store. Right. And he said if people really loved Pimlico, the people who lived there really loved Pimlico, they would like make it grander than like the Hanging Gardens of Babylon or something like that. Or it becomes, you know, he said a mother doesn't put a ribbon on her child's hair to cover up ugliness. It's because she already thinks they're beautiful.
Sure.
Kind of thing, you know.
Sure.
If our attitude to church is there's problems and I'm just going to abandon it and go do my own thing, then I would say, yes, there are problems. Bigness could be a problem. There could be legitimate sin in there. But abandoning it is not loving the church.
Right.
Right, which is another
way
of not loving Christ.
That's right.
And definitely, if you look at it and your attitude is, well, my needs and myself and my person and my actualization is what matters and how dare this church get in my way, whatever way they're doing with its doctrines, its creeds, or its institutional stuff, then you're definitely not loving the church and definitely not loving Christ. You're loving yourself above all else.
That's right.
And I feel like that would be...
That's right.
Maybe if we learn to really love the church better instead of loving ourselves or just being generally angry at things,
yeah.
If we learn to love the church better, we would say, you know, maybe the CEO model needs to be tweaked, or, you know, maybe it needs to die because it isn't doing much good. Maybe we need to like have this art therapy thing, but we need to find some way to integrate it in with some, like maybe bring someone more evangelistic along who will help out with like this other. Maybe we need to change things. Maybe some things need to die. Maybe some things need to remain and be conserved. Maybe some new things need to be built.
Sure.
But I feel like stifling, and I said petrification earlier, right? That's kind of the problem. It's where a thing just kind of solidifies and is resistant to all and any change, including good change.
That's right.
Right? That's bad, but dissolution is also bad. Both petrification and dissolution are both a sign of, like, decay.
Right. Right?
You either become stale or, you know, putrefies in some way.
So the key then would be to find out what really are the living bones of the institution and retain those as best we can. and allow the flesh on those bones to change as necessary to be alive, you know.
Right, and to love the Christ who founded and loves the church.
Right.
I say the Christ. I mean, to love Christ, the actual Christ, the God-man incarnate Christ that the church is loved by and is trying to love him as best as it can. That needs to be central. That needs to be bigger than all models and all ministries and all, you know, preferences, opinions, wishes, and wants, or something like that.
Sure.
That needs to be the summum bonum.
That's right. And I think we're talking a little bit about idolatry because it's possible to make the institutional church your God.
Yeah.
And in so doing, then you have some of the problems you just described. Right. You either are too conservative, that is, you want to sustain it at all costs, even when it's become petrified. Or you want to change it all the time because it isn't satisfying your needs. You see, the problem with an idol is always that it looks like it's going to satisfy your needs, and then when it doesn't, you hate it.
Mm-hmm.
You love it in order for it to satisfy you, and then when it doesn't come through, then the result is we don't just ignore it, we hate it, we despise it.
Right.
And so in that case, we want to undo everything about it, and we want to restructure something that will be an idol that we think will satisfy us. And we're just going from idol to idol to idol then, and we're not actually turning to the real God and following him. We need to wrap up, I'm afraid. Suggestions here at the end. My suggestion is that
Your recommendation.
My recommendation is we don't have any recommendations.
Very well.
Only because of time constraints, but we'll pick up on that next time, and maybe if we've got some extra recommendations, we could stick them in. All right?
Very good. Well, we thank you guys for joining us. This has been From the Center, and we'll see you next time.